So this bottle that you see on the slide is what two-thirds of the inventory of Serge Lutens fragrances look like. Sort of like Chanel has, number five has a very definitive shape where you notice the juice a little bit more. Then there are other bottles that look like bell jars and some special ones that Serge Lutens makes. Just keep that in the back of your mind, it's relevant. This is Serge Lutens. This picture is by Richard Avedon. I think just looking at him, you can see he's kind of an intense guy. But he also is a very warm and intelligent person. He has a statement on perfume that I think probably sums it up better than anyone else who makes fragrances as said. He says, "Perfume resides at the very heart of us. It is a means of self-expression. It is the dot on our eye, a way of contemplating ourselves and sensing who we really are. It is also in some ways a weapon, which seduces more by consequence than design." Mm-hmm. Perfume exists in the first person. Do you know his first perfume store in Paris also had a bookstore inside of it? It's kind of telling you something about him. This is Serge Lutens, I think when he was about 9 or 10. And these are little key points from his website about how he sees the world. "The scent memories we retain the longest are the ones formed between ages 8 and 10. This is a time when we are most curious and open." This has been proven by science. This is a fact. "We self-reflect when we are smelling, which is why this sense is capable of producing a flood of memories that can take us back in time." This is the Proust effect that most of us are familiar with. "Infinite combinations of smells derived from our foundational olfactory palate inform scent experiences over time." So what this means is, in the last class, I think I showed a mica rock. And if you imagine the layers coming off, right, all that underside of mica exists under that top piece. The thing we know the most is what's on top and a little bit of what's on the bottom. And what's in the middle is harder for us to get at. "We measure unfamiliar smells against what we know. This can make the shock of the new exciting and terrifying." So this goes to the pleasure and fear principle that's behind detecting things with the human sensor, which is also known as the nose. Serge Lutens likes to play with unexpected notes in his perfume narratives. "These complementary contrasts reflect his belief that identity is not always fixed." You can kind of tell what he thinks about gender and perfume by just seeing that. And we'll get to that too. This is a direct quote. "I is an ever-evolving objet. It is the beginning and end of creation." And this image you see here, this is actually a model, and these were some fashion shoots that Serge Lutens did. All the imagery you see here, pretty much, a lot of it is drawn from the website and other things he's done. So Serge Lutens has a lot in common with Chanel. Most people don't know this. So here are the things that bring them together. Serge Lutens and Gabrielle Chanel both love the smell of skin. For Gabrielle Chanel, it was the smell of freshly scrubbed skin. For Serge Lutens, it's the smell of warm skin, kind of like the yin and the yang. "The smell of human skin is the scent of love and comfort. It's also the scent of trust and bonding. And for both of these creators, there's a place where this comes together. Chanel's mother died when she was very young. She was abandoned by her father, who sent her to an orphanage. Lutens' mother became pregnant with him, when her husband was away at war, and she gave him up for adoption. So he was abandoned too. Both designers forged unique identities. And because of that, they became fashion icons in spite of that abandonment. So they sort of rebelled against this rejection that they had very early in their life, and they define themselves in very unique and clear ways. So amber and cedar are touch points for Serge Lutens. In his life, he's had experiences. He lives in Morocco now. He spent a lot of time there even prior to living there. And these two ingredients, which are used in perfumery, are part of the Moroccan culture. He said, "Marrakesh is what produced my penchant for perfume and awoke my sense of smell." Now, something that happened to Serge Lutens, and I've tried to replicate it, and I think I have, was he was in a souk and he had a Thuja wood box that he found, and inside of it he put a piece of amber. Not amber that comes from pine trees, you know, that sort of comes down like sap, but amber is also a material of, composed of several aromatics that's used to scent clothes, to scent skin. They're these little cubes. So the smell is sort of sweet, salty. Some people have said to me a little like Play-Doh, but not quite. And it's redolent of vanilla, caramelized sugar, and musk. It usually also contains something called ambrox, which is an aroma molecule that's synthesized in the lab that is a big part of what defines, you know, the whole amber composition in fragrances, especially oriental fragrances. Vanillin crystals, you can sort of see them. That molecule comes from vanilla. They sort of form on the top of surface and around the body of the amber. And it's not a sign that it's bad. It's just that's what the molecule does. They come in different colors. They can be light. They can be dark. It depends on what's in them. It also depends if they've been exposed to oxygen, because vanillin turns brown when it's exposed to air. But amber cubes can stay fragrant for an indefinite amount of time. This piece, does anyone ever eaten any food with black cardamom? So this is totally not like cardamom, green cardamom, and the bleached version, which is white cardamom as we know it. It's smoky, it's camphoraceous, and it also has a little bit of a eucalyptus note. And those things together are what Thuja wood smells like. So words that are commonly used to describe Sursuten's perfumes are powerful, mysterious, bold, spellbinding, hypnotic, which we get a lot, I hear that a lot in class, voluptuous, opulent, and carnal. This, like for almost everything, he gets very close. So these are quotes from Serge Lutens about what he thinks about smell, creativity, aphrodisiacs, and gender. Some of these are my favorite. I never learned to love a smell, however, I allowed myself to be invaded. My imagination fires up in the early morning between 5:30 and 6 a.m. and is highly productive in terms of creativity and paranoia until around 2 p.m. And that's when I assume he has coffee. To be precise, there is no such thing as an aphrodisiac perfume. Only aphrodisiac people. Think about that. Perfume is a product aimed at the senses, not at a particular gender. I can't emphasize how true this is, because roses smell great on guys and girls and anybody in between. If you like it and it smells good, you should own it. Yes?
If that's the case, why does the perfume industry so dominantly promote perfumes for one gender or the other?
So we're talking about marketing. And we're talking about history and the roles of men and women in France. So in Grasse, at the time perfumery was kind of coming up and around, it was very traditional roles. If you were in the elite, women still didn't work. You know, they got to wear the nice gowns and the jewelry, lots of perfume, because it really smelled bad then. You know, didn't have sanitation and certain things that we have now. And men had their roles of being strong. So woody fragrances tended to be masculine, you know. And then citrus ones for men, the eau de cologne style, were considered fresh and clean, right? Because the antithesis of that is you were in the lower classes and you were working, and so you had body odor. And for women, of course, the rose and other flowers were traditionally attributed to them. That also goes back to, you know, early Christianity, the association of the Virgin Mary with roses, saints with roses. Various mythologies, actually, where flowers are also associated with women because, you know, the way female genitalia looks and the way, you know, the way a flower looks. I mean, look at a Georgia O'Keeffe picture, you know. So that's my answer, is it starts out being cultural. But I think that we found that as societies evolved and roles have changed and start to come to almost being equal, we're not quite there yet because we're just not, then you're seeing the change happen in perfumery and the emphasis of that, which I think is very interesting. There's so much that perfumery teaches that very few people know. It's not just, you know, going to a counter, you know, before the holidays and buying a present. It's way more than that. It's a great question. Thank you for asking it. So a little bit about Serge. To understand how he became who he was, aside from his being orphaned at childhood and his very interesting quotes, He began his career as a photographer at Vogue. That's where he started. And he went on to work for Christian Dior, Shiseido, and then his own beauty brand. So photography, film, cosmetics, and perfumes are the mediums in which he works as a creative person. He creates in the present. He's detached from influences that tempt many to drop anchor in the past or project wildly into the future. I find this absolutely fascinating about someone who's involved in marketing products too, because I think his work is really is art that happens to be marketable. And I think that oftentimes when we're selling something in the business, we are trying to create something that's a fantasy, right? It either exists or it doesn't. He's not concerned with that. He's concerned with the, whatever it is that's motivating him at the time and the expression of that, which is very artistic. He thrives on the subtle trace of chaos that lives in a fleeting moment, and perfume really adequately captures that. This manifests as complementary contrasts in his perfume. Some of the game, the citrus smells against the amber and Ombre Sultan, that's part of the complementary contrast. You have something very deep and very strong, and then something very light, and then they're sort of playing against each other. And they don't crash and collide into each other. They sort of show each other a little bit more. Which, if we get into this just a little bit and think about people, if people are not alike and you bring them together, there's the middle space of what happens when differences exist. I want to stay on that metaphor a little bit just because we're living in a time in the culture where overall, the culture is forgetting that, the value of that. And if you cook, if you bake, you understand that. You put ingredients together, what you make smells completely different than just the individual ingredients by themselves. You know, so the world is a fantastic, great super cake. The thing about Lutens too that's really interesting is if he has certain notions about things and he sees they're not working in his creative process, he'll drop them. Not many people do that very easily. And he's really interested in forging a new way of sensing each time he makes something. And the reason why he has throngs of followers who love his perfume and spend $150 and $300 a bottle, I'm guilty, is because when he says something in the olfactory fashion, using the art of perfumery, he means it. Each time. This is not la-di-da, let's make something and put it on the market. It's not how he works. His vision is not predicated on the predictable rates of evaporation, meaning some perfumers know, well, if I use this as a middle note, you'll smell the flower for this amount of time, and then it will remind them of, you know, Mother's Day and this, and they're going into this all traditional place. And he's not going there. He wants to kind of be in a place that might provoke you a little bit, to think about of a traditional material maybe in a way that you never thought of it before. His style doesn't pander, it doesn't imitate, you never smell anything he makes and think, oh, this reminds me of, well, yeah, you'll get a fragment of an ingredient, but his stuff will not remind you often of other things. His lines are clear and sharp like the bottles that his perfumes are housed in, and he can make things that are comforting, edgy, and very unpredictable all simultaneously. So you have to be willing to go on an emotional roller coaster ride a little bit when you smell some of his fragrances. And one of the things we'll smell is going to take us on a pleasant ride. You won't need Dramamine for it. So this is another type of bottle. This was a special issue. So it's a bell jar shaped. It has some, you know, beautiful imprint on it. You can see the Moroccan influence. He opened up his store, Le Salon du Palais Royal, in 1992, and that's housed a bookshop before it was converted into perfumery. Morocco and Japan are influences in his life, the East. And you see it in the images of women that will be coming up when he did makeup and, you know, photography shoots. When you read one, when you experience one of his perfumes, you almost read it like a book. You kind of got to go a little bit. Mm-hmm. And as each time as you smell, like, the story starts to become clearer. And I think that what his intention is for a perfume often gets transformed by your own identity and own experience. And I don't think the way these fragrances are made or positioned is to make you just experience the thing he may say in words, or that's an ad copy. Really, his ad copy is really not with a lot of words most of the time. It's just an image. But when he speaks about fragrances, he never tries to impose his point of view on people. He just talks about what inspired him. So Serge does not make his perfumes by himself, although you can see he has very clear ideas about what he's doing. And his collaborator is Christopher Sheldrake. So Christopher Sheldrake actually is an accidental perfumer. He originally went to study architecture in France, studying math and physics and art as well. He spent some time in France so he could learn French, and he kind of fell in love with France, but he was in Grasse, which is, you know, the mother of perfumery in Western culture, and he kind of fell in love. So his path was he worked for fragrance houses. He worked for Quest a lot when he was working with Monsieur Lutens. Quest was acquired by Givaudan. And then Christopher Sheldrake was snatched by Chanel. He's now in charge of R&D there. And what was interesting, and I didn't know this until I did research on this, I mean, I knew it was unusual to have two brands kind of come together when one was not working on a project that was going to benefit both brands. Chanel has allowed Sheldrake to be involved with Lutens because they also have some niche luxury lines they've developed. And they feel that in order to understand what that means in the culture and for perfumery, that having a perfumer who's in charge of R&D continue to do what he already was doing was a wise move. I'm sure lots of NDAs and papers were signed. It's not a common thing, but I think it's a wonderful thing. But also their chemistry is so wonderful. You can't work together for 23 years and make these beautiful things without, like, human chemistry. So one of the things I admire about Sheldrake is, you know, in academia, it's really easy to live in a silo. What does that mean? That means you have your area of specialty, you stay in your house, you lock the doors, and that's all you do. And you don't open up the windows to see what's outside. That's a very dangerous thing to do, especially in a global world. So Sheldrake says, and I quote, "If you work on one thing only, and then you just don't see it anymore. Then you just don't see it anymore. It's like being in the eye of the tornado. You get really excited about what you are doing, but you don't see it at all. It's good to be able to stand back and have a fresh look at things." So he's talking about perspective. It's important to know about things that you don't do to understand what you do. That makes him a really great collaborator. He was interviewed in an online publication, rather an online website called Base Notes. They have some wonderful articles. And these are two quotes from this article. "What I like most is when somebody likes a fragrance that I've made and they close their eyes and smile. I think that is really is a sign that it's doing something," right? People were closing their eyes before and smelling, right? So people are fed up with the big brands that are all making the same thing because it was a la mode, because it was successful. The niche brands have come up with alternative ideas, and that's all to do with communication and people putting their point over. In this case, he was referring to what was happening online. So in 2007, I started a blog called Glass Petal Smoke. And the reason why I started it was I had this training in perfumery. I was consulting for fragrance brands, and I felt that this beautiful education that I had, that I was privileged to have, that I, so many ways I probably shouldn't have had, shouldn't be so damn secretive. Because it's art, it's science, it's history, it's so many disciplines tied in together, and it's too beautiful to lock down. And so my approach to blogging, and there was a lot of fragrance blogging, started back in 2004 or 3, a lot of blogs were really about reviewing fragrances, which is fine. I wasn't content with that. That's not what I chose. And as a result, at some point, I went to Givaudan, where I got my training, and said, "I would like to unlock the charts that were used in my training. Will you let me do this? I've written an article for Perfumer and Flavorist magazine. Please let me do this." And I appealed to the head perfumer who was head of training, Jean Guichard, and they let me do it. A few years later, now you can go on academia.edu and download it, because I got permission from Perfumer and Flavorist not only to release that, but everything I wrote for them, which were three articles. I would, if you have a chance to read Exposing the Perfumer, I would read it. It's not because I wrote it. It's because I wrote it at a time when everything was starting to become open about what this process was that perfumers were involved in and why it was valuable and what the internet was doing to perfumers who were hiding behind the Wizard of Oz curtain because nobody would let them out, right? So if someone made fragrances for Donna Karan, I'm not saying, you know, she does this now, she doesn't, but they wouldn't let the perfumer come out because it's about the brand, it's about Donna Karan or, you know, anybody else. And now you see a lot of collaboration where the perfumers are with the face of the brand and everything is open, and it should be that way. And this is one of the great things about the internet. And so he's referring to the putting the point online. He's talking about what the culture did. So the way a fragrance is created in the industry, there's a document. It's called a fragrance brief. Sometimes it's not a document. It can be very intricate. It could be a PowerPoint with pictures and words and poems and all kinds of things. It could be a single photograph. It could be a conversation that people have through the internet or across the desk. There are all shapes and sizes of fragrance briefs. I actually wrote one for Terry Mugler. It was a very interesting project. It was their first fragrance where they collaborated with Victoria's Secret to distribute it in their stores. It was called Innocent Secret, so that gave me a lot of insight into what that process was. It was very exciting. There's a lot of fantasy in briefs. So to do a brief in a way that makes things clear and also evokes something authentic, almost compels a perfumer when they read it, I know what they're talking about, like you need to get to that. So Lutens, because his brand is a niche brand, doesn't have to rely on a lot of fireworks and a PowerPoint or some idea that talks about the future that's everyone's talked about. He has an idea and he has this one person that he works with. And that's what he does. And yes, it gets vetted by marketing because these are products that have to be sold and there's profit and loss lines in corporations. But the creative process has been respected from the beginning of the time the brand was established and still continues today. Shiseido's really good about being hands-off and letting Lutens, even though he sold his trademark this year to them, he's 73, so he wants to be the director, but he's sort of stepping back a little. He wants to make sure his fragrances are well taken care of and he can still produce things in the style that he's accustomed to. And I'm sure he will be, and he'll be taken care of, and the brand will be that way. He doesn't see things as fixed, right? Because we kind of get that. He goes from one thing to the next. One perfume smells like this, one perfume smells like this. So a brief would lock him down. It would probably eviscerate him. He would need a lot of antacids, and that whole thing about after 2 p.m., his inspiration was gone. He'd be in bed depressed if he had to do a fragrance brief. So there are things about his process that are unique, and so I found three quotes that I'd like to share with you. This one is about beginnings. It all happens in work sessions and during the course of an ongoing monologue with input from Christopher Sheldrake, who provides technical and legal support. As far as I'm concerned, this creative process is a bit like casting a spell. My work is essentially far more akin to that of a sorcerer than a perfumer. Nevertheless, pure creation is a language that belongs only to the person using it. The only partner in the creative process is the perfume itself. My God, if people could collaborate and think just about the work and leave their egos at the door and their attachment to truths and to what they think is not true, they could create beautiful things. I'm not just speaking about aesthetically, I'm talking about solving global problems, right? So you can learn from this. So what's the path? It's a choice you make right from the start. A desire to keep forging ahead, using the vocabulary of scents and essential oils to form a sentence, then a novel, and then a title, until you end up with a fragrance at the end of the process. However, at the same time, you're being guided by the fragrance, which tells you whether you're doing what it wants or not. At this point, you're in a state of complete osmosis. Two become one. The number two is an anathema for the creative process. It's all about oneness. And when you finally tear yourself away from it, you can see yourself reflected in it. This is his view on inspiration. Again, these are women he's done the makeup for. This is part of his history. This is not a random photo. It isn't a conscious decision. The work has me in its grip and won't let go. What you call inspiration travels a long way to get here. It is generated by my life, and that is developed and deepened over an unspecified length of time. It is only when I'm on the home stretch that the tension builds, resulting in a feeling of oneness between the perfume and myself, the point when I merge with the perfume and we become one. The fragrance is the true collaborator in this creative process, since it is guiding my senses. You can't relax until that process has run its course. Only then you can heave a sigh of relief and stop holding your breath. You know, we always want to get to the end when we're working on a project. It's nice the way he recognizes that. And it's also nice the way he allows the work to define the outcome. It's not about him so much. He influences it. He's maybe the fulcrum. So a lot of what he talks about feeds into a concept called design thinking that was developed at Stanford University and is taken on the road by a company called IDEO. I happen to have the privilege of being at Stanford and seeing one of these things explained. And there's a process that you go through when you want to make something. Now, design thinkers are trying to solve what they perceive as being real issues. So they want to understand what they're dealing with, observe something around that subject, synthesize all that information, then start to brainstorm in ideation, make prototypes based on the problem they're trying to solve, and then have implementation. So the way you take that into the perfume world and into the relationship with Christopher Sheldrake and Serge Lutens is the fragrance designer and perfumer communicate the scent concept and they clarify the narrative. What are we making? Right? So they get to know that. The perfumer creates a few fragrance formulas called mods. A mod is short for modification. Some perfumes can go up to 300 or 400 mods if the brand has tons of money. These days, 100. 120, because you want to get to market quickly. Serge Lutens is still working on things that he's been spending eons on, just so you know, that haven't come to light of day yet. So once the mods are made, you know, the designer and the perfumer, Lutens and Sheldrake, work to see, are we hitting the mark? And then when they get it, et voila, we get a perfume, and you have what you smell. So creative process is part of what's embedded in design thinking. We hear a lot about creative process. We're hearing a lot of things in the culture now about the importance of creativity to the point that it's being commodified. You can't commodify creativity. And I don't believe it's also something, well, you have it or you don't. You can do creative things. How do you do them? So let's go back to design thinking, right? So solving problems in design thinking is about solving having a process that is human-centric, as opposed to, well, I want to make widgets. I just want to make a product. And you want a meaningful solution, right? There's an element of authenticity in it. And some people find that what's being preached in design thinking is a little bit of packaged creativity. I think it depends how you use it. I wouldn't sort of get that binary. The making aspect in art is usually not tied to an outcome. Like, so you think about how Lutens and Sheldrake work, maybe there's a story, but the end part doesn't exist yet, right? And they're comfortable with that. And they can go and they can change and they can throw things out or just dump the whole project altogether, right? It's very different, right? It's because art problem makes, right? And in business and in design, you problem solve. So they're opposite ways that eventually meet at the middle. So creative process for people who make perfume is centered on meaning making, so that when you smell that water or you wear that perfume on skin, it does something to you, whatever that something is. So for Serge Lutens, fragrance is a collaborator. He said that in a few places, right? He almost turns it into a being. I wish people could talk about their work that way and have respect for work and the essence of something. It doesn't have to be perfume. He's been working on a fragrance. Wood is another word for agarwood, which is agarwood is a type of tree that they make a wound in the bark. A resin comes out, but unlike frankincense, it's actually encourages the development of a fungus. And then you get this sort of sticky substance a little bit, and then the wood changes, and you get something that smells amazing, but is a little, well, it's very animalic, slightly fecal, and a little funky. But if you mix it with florals or other ingredients, it makes it feel like they came to life. It's a very amazing ingredient. However, most of it is bought up by Saudi Arabia because it's part of the culture, and also, you know, you have to have money to afford it. It has unfortunately been over-harvested, so you can only get sustainable versions of it, which are quite different. I actually have a 15-year-old oud in a 15% dilution that I showed in a talk I gave at the University of Michigan about sustainability. And I showed some other things. I showed Douglas fir, and I said, imagine if, you know, you had Christmas and you couldn't get a Christmas tree. You know, part of why things are sometimes reformulated or changed is because we strip stuff from the land, or we do it too fast. Sandalwood disappeared, and other types of sandalwood cultivated in other countries outside of India were used, and they're okay. They don't smell like sandalwood from India, although that is coming back. It takes a long time for those trees to grow. It really does. There is another fragrance, actually it was his first, that he made called Féminité du Bois. And cedar figures very prominently in this scent. And when he's relating to it, he talks about harmony in the discord. Again, this is how you deal with contrasts, right? You look for that middle place, even if it's a mystery space. So it is the second perfume. I'm trying to remember, you'll have to forgive me. I think it's Nombre Noir was the first fragrance he made, and he made it under the Shiseido brand. I am praying, since he sold his trademark to Shiseido, that they bring it back because it's drop-dead gorgeous. But this was the first time he collaborated with Sheldrake. Now, here's an interesting story. Master perfumer Pierre Baudin and Sheldrake worked together to create an accord that's actually in this. Now, if you meet them separately, as co-creators, right? Each will give the other one credit. Never seen something like this before. Usually you want to snatch the credit for yourself. Now this is a very interesting fragrance. And the reason why it's interesting is you will recognize some of this signature I'm talking about. I will say not more than that. So Dame Blonde means blonde suede. And it's hard for me to explain how it smells, but I will say what Serge says. As blonde as a sweet, as yellow as corn silk, as gold as the sun or a golden boy or whatever else you can imagine. Let's do what children do. First, a child looks at an object. He picks it up. If he brings it to his nose as he would this soft suede scent, it's in search of consolation. That's exactly what I want my fragrance to do, to console. So there is a darker leather in the line of Serge Lutens perfumes. It used to be available in the bottles that you had seen in the video and on some of the slides. However, now it's only sold in the bell jar style, which is $300. I leave it to you to decide what's worthwhile. I have two bell jar fragrances. I'm just going to tell you what I have. I have Musk's Kublai Khan, and I probably shouldn't have done this, but Borneo, and there's a date that I can't remember, but it's a scent that uses chocolate. And I smelled it on my skin, and I just destroyed myself and ordered it at Aida's. It should be coming any day now. And I'm going to hear about it from my husband. Oh, so this is queer Mauresque. Moorish leather. This is the perfume that Serge Lutens wears. And he doesn't say it like, oh, this is my perfume. It's just out of everything he makes, he wears this nearly daily. And it is inspired by everything he loves about Morocco. So there's a history of tanning leather. In Morocco, in Fez here, you can see dye vats and other things. You can imagine all the strange and unusual smells that come along with that. But this fragrance has a fruity twist that's dry, dark, and slightly sweet. There's a lot of contrast in it. If you like it, if you choose to wear it, small amount. So there's citrus, musk, and attars that are, so I should back away from this a little bit. So an attar is a scent that is oil-based. These are traditional in Arab culture because alcohol is not halal. You can't use it in a fragrance. So in the early days of tanning leather, you know, leather has a smell. Now we have modern chemicals that we use, and the smell that we think is leather is actually the scent additive given to the skin. Leather by itself that's unscented smells a little nasty. And also in the earlier days of tanning, if you don't properly remove the flesh from the skin, you get something really appalling. And also like certain skins, like goat skins, tend to have more of an odor, kind of like goat cheese, right? You know, this is all relative. So they used to use musk, attars, and citrus scents in the processing of leather. They don't do that anymore. I mean, if someone does it, then maybe they're just trying to harken back to the days because they're making a specific type of product. But this is important to know because it's what inspired the scent. And I'm going to call out the notes this time outright because I think it's important to know them, because this one kind of has a kapow. So the amber, which was in what we smelled in the beginning, right, with the black cardamom, myrrh, burnt styrax. Styrax is a resin, smells a little bit like vanilla or the paper in an old book. Cinnamon, aloes wood, which is another word for oud. Cedar, civet. Civet is an animalic ingredient, also can be synthesized, smells a little bit like poopy diapers. But this is not what the perfume smells like. Anytime you use an animalic in a fragrance, it generally makes everything else bouquet, unless the scent is designed to give you an animalic push, which, by the way, musk's Kublai Khan does. And some people find that offensive. It doesn't smell bad on me, so I wear it. Nutmeg, clove, cumin. Some people don't like that because it reminds them of the smell of body odor. But you have to think about cumin. Like if you put cumin in a pan and you heat it before you're cooking, think about that cumin. And then you also have musk, mandarin peel, and orange blossom. So the flower and the fruit together. Fragrance is identity, right? We went through this earlier in the presentation. So my assessment of how I see Serge: fragrance is identity for Serge Lutens. You may enter his olfactory world when you wear his latest scent, but don't expect to find white chalk lines around the bottles of his perfumes when they are completed and put to rest. Once a Serge Lutens perfume has entered the world, the master's passport catches fire, and he assumes a new identity that is a melding of the man he once was and now is, perfumed by the threads of a cocoon that he will shed after his next fragrance creation. That is who this man is. The dot on the eye, identity. Look at the bottle. The dot on the eye. So you know where to get the perfumes if you like them. I have to admit that part of my goal is to share the love of fragrances I have with others. I think making the world fragrant is a good thing, especially with good perfume. So in closing, I'm hoping we've learned more about perfumery today, but I'm also hoping that some of the things that you've learned will also make you think about how we interact with others in the world. But if you think of some of the things we learned here about stuff that makes us kind of pull back first, and then when we give it time, we can go in. When you get into those uncomfortable spaces, whether it's with people, perfumes, or food, give yourself some space to try and get as objective as you can and to give something or someone a chance. If you come away with just that today, I'll have done my civic duty. If you come away with more, I'll have accomplished what I hope to, which is to introduce you to a new way of seeing the world through your sense of smell. So thank you for allowing me to do that.
Thank you. Thank you.